It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, our hearts can't seem to go on from the idea of shipwrecks, especially the Titanic. We talked to the author of a new book about what goes into discovering them, exploring them, and why so many sunken ships are still missing. Now, Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke today for the first time since the FBI searched the Florida estate of former President Donald Trump earlier this week.
First, I personally approved the decision to seek a search warrant in this matter. Second, the department does not take such a decision lightly.
Attorneys for the former president have said the search was related to documents taken from the White House as Trump left office, documents that archivists and others say belong to the federal government under the Presidential Records Act. The New York Times has reported that some of those documents were classified and believed to be highly sensitive documents related to national security. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this news? What questions do you have about this FBI search and the rules around classified documents? What do you want to hear from the Justice Department beyond what we heard from the Attorney General today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He's the author of the book Politainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me again, and thank you to the audience.
Seems like there's maybe more that we don't know at this point than we do know, but what are the basics? What stands out to you as the key facts in this chain of events right now?
Well, first, what's important to note here is that the Justice Department, the FBI, just can't go in, and contrary to what people are saying, and ransack a place. They have to go to a judge. They have to convince them that they have probable cause, that there is a reason to search, that that probable cause has to indicate what they're looking for and why they think there is evidence of a crime or something like that. And that's just important. I wanted to mention right off the bat here so that it's not like it's just sort of it happens or something like that. So what stands out to me is first the fact that they could convince a judge in a situation like this that there was probable cause to do a search, that believed that there was some evidence of a crime. Now, we think it's related to, as you pointed out here, the Presidential Records Act, but it could also be information tied into the investigation for the January 6th investigation. We just don't know. There's a lot we don't know at this point. And once the search warrant is unsealed, we're going to have a little bit better idea. But right now, what's striking me is the fact that normally this would be, if it were like David Schultz or was Jane Doe, whoever it be, we wouldn't be making a big deal out of it. And this would be a pretty routine search. The fact that it's an ex-president of the United States in a highly charged political atmosphere, that's what's causing a lot of the issues. And plus, I would say that I suspect this is why Merrick Garland said he thought hard about it. And I suspect a judge thought long and hard about this before issuing the warrant.
I want to listen again to Attorney General Merrick Garland earlier today on that topic of the warrant.
Just now, the Justice Department has filed a motion in the Southern District of Florida to unseal a search warrant and property receipt relating to a court-approved search that the FBI conducted earlier this week.
I want to break that down. As I understand it, these are items that President Trump, via his lawyers, would have, the actual warrant and the receipt of what was removed from Mar-a-Lago. That is what Merrick Garland is saying. Hey, we want this released to the public, based in part on the fact that former President Trump had talked about this search publicly. What would that mean?
It mean to release it? Well, first off, it's of course the case that Donald Trump could release the information regarding the warrant because the warrant had to be issued to him. So it's his choice. He could have already released it. The second thing is that this warrant wasn't issued by a judge until after, what my understanding is, there had been already efforts and requests made to the president and his staff to return what they think were items that were improperly taken from the White House and placed, at Mar-a-Lago. And so those are, I think, are important things to underscore here in terms of it. And when the Justice Department making the request for the warrant to be unsealed, once that happens, we're going to have a full idea regarding what crime the president was being potentially investigated for, what the search was looking for. It's going to have to state with particularity what they're looking for. We're going to get a lot of details that will clue us in exactly where I think the investigation is going.
And that could take a while. Now, one thing that isn't included in that, as I understand it again, is the case made to that magistrate judge, the background information, what led them to ask for this warrant, that wouldn't be revealed. And that's information that might affect an ongoing investigation, too. There's a limit as to what we would see if this stuff got released.
You're absolutely correct, because under standard, let's say, freedom of information requests, and generally, which is what the case in this country, if there's an ongoing criminal investigation, the prosecution, or in this case, the Justice Department, does not have to release that information because it could obviously affect the case in some way. So we're just going to get to see the warrant. The warrant, again, is going to specify what they were searching for and where to look for it. So we're going to get that kind of an idea in terms of the items that they were looking for. And it's, again, important to understand here, warrants can't be fishing expeditions. They have to state, this is a legal term here, they have to state with particularity the persons, places, or effects that are going to be searched and what they're looking for.
Talking to David Schultz, political science professor at Hamline University, law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at the FBI a search of Mar-a-Lago, the home of former President Trump. The announcement, the brief announcement by Attorney General Merrick Garland talking about it today. A lot of open questions there. Do you have questions, reactions you want to share? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, I think a lot of people out there are extrapolating from this search in different directions in ways that I think outrun the facts at this point. One line of reaction is, aha, this means former President Trump is about to be indicted, whether people like that idea or not. We don't know that yet, right?
Correct. We don't know that. It is entirely possible that when they did the search, they did not find any evidence of a crime. And therefore, we can't make that kind of conclusion that would go the next step. But even if they found some stuff, there still has to be a determination whether or not the possession of this material was in violation of the law. Is there, again, at the end of the day, enough evidence to now indict a person? The requirements for doing a search warrant are not as significant as actually indicting somebody, which of course eventually means even if somebody is indicted, as we all know, it has to be what, proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's a various stages or levels of proof here, and mere search warrant does not constitute or give us evidence that somebody is imminently or if at all going to be indicted for a crime.
Another line of reaction, mostly from former President Trump supporters, is, aha, this shows that the Biden administration is misusing the Justice Department to target a political opponent. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, the check in the system is a judge. At the end of the day, let us say for the sake of argument, Merrick Garland said, I'm just going to get the ex-president. We're just going to make his life miserable. He still would have to go and convince with evidence. Again, we're not going to know what is right now. Convince a judge to issue a search warrant. That, according to our Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, is the check upon, let us say, this type of allegation of rogue political activity. Now, I also want to point out here, I think it's important to think about sort of, let's say, parity here. Remember back in 2016, there were allegations that then Secretary Clinton, Hillary Clinton, who was running for president, that she had also violated the Presidential Records Act. And there were warrants issued up for her server, including, remember, an investigation that was reopened, what, just a matter of days before the election. The reason why I mention this, put these two together here. We actually have a Justice Department now that has pursued its duty against both a Democrat when a Democrat was president, and has pursued it now against a Republican. And so for people who are saying, you know, what's the big deal? This is all political. No, in both cases, judges served as the check. And the people who are doing a lot of the decisions here are the civil service. They're also the apolitical people who are not the appointees.
And some have gone further, including at least one United States senator saying that the FBI might have planted evidence that they claim to have obtained during the raid. This, I think, going well beyond any knowable facts at this point.
It does. And also, given the security that is probably at Mar-a-Lago, it's a private residence, a private country club, if I remember correctly, that I think it would be very difficult for the FBI to somehow sneak in, plant this evidence, convince a judge that there's real evidence there that they need to search for. This is, I don't want to quite say getting us up to kind of the UFOs and Elvis sightings arguments, but I would say it kind of gets us in that direction.
We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago and what it tells us about possible legal risks facing former President Donald Trump and the procedures, the legal procedures involved in doing a search like this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Based on what you've seen so far, often limited information, do you think this is the right move by federal law enforcement? Do you worry about this search coming off as political? What kind of oversight do you think there should be in a case like this? What questions do you have? What reactions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's estate, Mar-a-Lago in Florida. What we know, what we still don't know. David Schultz with Hamline University and the University of Minnesota stays with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is your reaction? What questions do you have about all of this? What's your reaction to the reactions you've seen out there? Do you know people upset by this, happy about this, all of the above? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David, in one sense, as you suggested earlier, this is kind of routine business for the FBI. They go to a judge, they get a search warrant, they execute the search warrant. It is very non-routine. It's a former president. It's going to get more scrutiny. Do you think it should have more scrutiny given the, you know, a concern about even if this is legit, this is a power that could be abused in the future?
You know, I'm sort of two minds on this. You know, when I first heard the story about this, I thought to myself, this is good. This proves that even presidents or former presidents aren't above the law, that they too, you know, have to, you know, honor a search warrant and follow it. So that's sort of one mind. The other mind is, let's say, from a more realistic perspective, I can't help but think that when the Justice Department went before the judge in Southern District of Florida and said, we want a search warrant, even though he's not supposed, or he or she, I'm not sure if it was a male or female judge, but the judge probably is thinking it's a former president. There really better be a lot of good evidence here for supporting this. And so I suspect de facto, in reality, the burden was even greater on the Justice Department because of who the person was. And I think everybody thought about this probably a little bit more because of the possible, let's say, political blowback or repercussions that might occur if this didn't go well. So I think in reality, probably a lot more evidence than would be required if they were searching, let us say, most of the listeners out there with a warrant.
We heard from Cole in Madison at 800-642-1234, couldn't stay on the line, but says it was important for the DOJ to clarify what the cause was to minimize politicization. Now, this is heavily politicized, a lot of political conversation about this. What did you think of that statement, David, from the Attorney General earlier this afternoon, explaining what he could and explaining what he couldn't tell us about?
Well, I think it helped a little bit in terms of trying to clarify some stuff. But I still come back and say the most important thing he did, I think, today was saying he was going to make that request to have the warrant released to the court. That, I think, gives us a lot more information. And the longer we wait on this, and I know the judicial system has to, you know, do its job or something like that, we're going to get a lot of, let's say, speculation. And I'm not sure if the Justice Department, our Garland statements today, did much to cut down on the speculation on either side at this point.
What do you think of some of the angry reaction that's been out there? Threats against members of the FBI, against the judge in particular, who, at least according to some information, released this information. That, in part, is what Attorney General Garland seemed to be speaking to as well today.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct here. And that, I think, is one of the scarier parts at this point, is the fact that we seem to be undergoing a crisis in confidence or a crisis in the trust in our judicial system. And somehow we think that everything is done for political reasons and that there isn't, let us say, a legitimate legal or, in this case, you know, criminal investigation purpose. And I don't know how to sort of fix that problem. Yeah, but I do want to come back again and say, I'm suspecting for many of those people who were criticizing what the judge did in the search warrant today, 5 years ago, approximately, that's actually longer, 2016, yes, you know, 6 years ago, were probably cheering when the FBI executed a search warrant against Hillary Clinton. And so I want to come back to that because they're closely parallel in terms of types of searches that were being done for possible violations of the same law.
Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, looking at this FBI search of former President Donald Trump's home and resort, Mar-a-Lago, looking apparently, according to some reports, for documents removed from the White House when the president left office. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions or questions. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David, according to some reporting, President Biden and his aides were caught by surprise with this search earlier this week and did not know that Attorney General Garland was going to make this address this afternoon. At least publicly facing, it seems like they're trying to really reinforce this idea that the Attorney General and the Justice Department are acting independently of the president.
If in fact that's accurate, that's actually a very good sign that there's been this on again, off again sort of assumption that the attorney general is what? The president's attorney. No, he is not. He's not his personal attorney. And the attorney general is supposed to act independently. You know, was it 50 years ago when there were concerns that Attorney General Mitchell was just operating as what? Almost a, I don't know, as Nixon's attorney during Watergate. People were saying, no, we need somebody independent to look at possible crimes. And so here it's sounding like what they did was to insulate, that is the Justice Department, insulated the president so he would not have any information regarding this. And I think this is actually good because you don't want the president sticking his nose in to these type of criminal investigations so that you can say that, listen, the Justice Department made its own decisions, followed its own internal procedures, went to court and did what it was supposed to do.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Denny is with us in Ogdensburg. Denny, hi.
I have a point. My question is, the Justice Department, I think, is morally or legally bound to not release documents to protect people who there was a warrant against in case they're innocent. But President Trump's got the warrant, and he's got the list of goods that were taken. He could release them anytime. If it's that ugly, why doesn't he release them?
Denny, thanks for the call. That would be an option, as I understand it, for President Trump, former President Trump, David, to release these documents.
Yeah, he could at any time release the warrant. He could describe what they were looking for, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I also want to underscore that this warrant apparently came as a last resort. There had already been requests made to the president and his staff saying that we think you have a variety of documents that you took with you when you left the White House and they're at Mar-a-Lago, made requests for it. Apparently, again, if the facts are accurate from what I understand, refused to honor those requests. And so the warrant becomes a last stage request, because, of course, we can always voluntarily comply with requests from the government. The warrant is when what? When somebody, in some case, has just refused to comply or follow the law.
Thanks for that call, Denny, at 800-642-1234. Rod joins us now in Minnesota. Rod, hi. Rod, are you there?
I just want to say that Donald Trump, from the day he probably was born, he sat there and he done this compulsive lying. And I believe that He'll keep doing it until the day he dies.
Rod, I gotcha. We heard the radio in the background there with a little delay. But can you talk about the former president's response so far, David, and how he has characterized this FBI search?
Well, he's characterized it as a raid, as an intrusion on his rights. I'm not sure if he's quite gotten to the point of saying, it's a bunch of thugs who are acting lawlessly and so forth. But clearly, he's put it in terms of other words like witch hunt. I can't remember the exact words he's using here. So he's not treating this very nicely. And it's also important to realize this has probably not been a good week for him, because at the same time this was going on, he was also back in New York with the ongoing investigation in New York regarding his business dealings. And he pleaded about the Fifth Amendment, apparently, what he said, to a variety of questions. So he's facing right now what appears to be multiple investigations on several fronts. I think there's still an ongoing investigation in the state of Georgia regarding his efforts to try to affect the election outcome there. So he's facing a lot of, let's say, legal challenges right now.
In our last minute or so, David, what are you watching for in this very obviously ongoing story?
Well, what I'm looking for, of course, is when the war is released and see what it says. And then that'll give me a better idea. Is it solely related to, again, the Presidential Records Act? How does this perhaps fit into what the January 6th committee is doing? And ultimately, how does it fit into perhaps any decision that the Justice Department may be making, possibly regarding any illegal activity the president has against surrounding January 6th. And so that's what I'm going to be looking to see at this point, how this warrant and how this information really sort of comes together in terms of helping with the investigation. But again, last point I want to bring up here. Remember, Donald Trump's a private citizen right now. He's not the president. All of us have an obligation to comply with the law. And even one of the things that we learned, again, from 50 years ago with the president of the United States, when they issued a search warrant to the president, presidents, even as presidents, are expected to comply with the law, because I think the broader statement is why nobody is above the Constitution in our society.
David, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and of law at the University of Minnesota, with us today to talk about what we know and don't know about the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago, former President Trump's home in Florida. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, climate researcher Michael Mann joins the program for a look at the climate change programs in the new bill passed by the U.S. Senate, expected to be voted on tomorrow by the U.S. House, looking at the impact those provisions could have on slowing down global warming. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. It's a supermoon alert, the last chance to see one this year, and it's coming tonight. As reported by NPR, tonight you can see the fourth and final supermoon of 2022. What's a supermoon? The moon has an elliptical orbit around Earth, not a perfect circle. So sometimes it's closer, sometimes it's further away. A supermoon is a full moon that happens near the closest point to Earth. That's still 226,000 miles away, by the way. Can we notice the difference when we look at it? Yeah. Supermoons look 17% bigger and 30% brighter than when the moon is furthest away. The official visible supermoon runs from about 8:30 tonight until Saturday morning. I peeked at weather forecasts for places around the state. A lot of the state is going to have mostly clear skies. Good supermoon viewing. Happy moon watching. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Jen White wraps up a week-long series on water, with the latest on how drought and new decisions on water policy affect America's farmers and the price we pay for our food. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, there have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. The Lusitania during World War I played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. but the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who obsessed over it, quested to find its remains and to bring them up to the surface, in some cases even claimed to own the wreck. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an interest in shipwrecks? Are you curious about them? Have you seen one up close? Maybe we've got a few different museums around the Great Lakes that show remains of shipwrecks. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your own memories, your questions for our guests. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Can you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it, and once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope, from the like amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals and all points in between. There's a lot of people who have done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers, and eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. I have my 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like one was there was a sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then off all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York. And that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought you would be interested in that, because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several hundred million dollars of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic, and just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books, and I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee, and from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north, Lake Michigan shore, down to Chicago in the 1800s. So people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees. And it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know. But the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made about the Titanic do especially well in China. And they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you've mentioned the boat and the ship and the song. And my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was a extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right, like Columbus or Da Gama. But we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. Scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is of course lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier, and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Daniel Stone, author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic, about mainly the Titanic and the people who looked to find its remains over the years, bring them up. A lot of human stories involved in that. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Zucchini is in the garden and at the farmer's market, and it's on the menu. We'll have recipes and advice. As always, I'll probably talk about the zucchini relish recipe I found online. Perfect for those really baseball bat-sized zucchinis that sometimes just grow out of control in one's garden. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. And what does it mean to be Midwestern? A new survey tried to get to the bottom of that question. And we will, too, with Charlie Behrens from Manitowoc Minute. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.